It's really getting kind of crazy out there, and I'm not just talking about walkouts. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. Along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry, it's great to be back with you. We skipped a week, basically due to the fact, and we have to give reports on these items, but due to the fact that I was up to my neck with the Relationships Under Construction banquet, and you were up to your neck with
the Bringing America Back to Life.
Yeah, Bringing America Back to Life conference. So, between us, we just ran out of time.
That's right. Now, you know, folks, sometimes we do, if we're even on the road and have a lot of things going on, sometimes we'll do a lot of remote stuff and take our equipment with us wherever we're going so that we can, like, just dial up to each other and start one going. But you can't do that when one person's got days locked down, the other person's got evening locked down. There's not much time to
record. There's no time in between. That's right.
But I think you guys had a very successful, if I remember hearing from you, a successful banquet with a sold out and overflow crowd, which was very nice to hear from you this morning when we did our monthly radio interview with Mike O'Reilly.
Yeah, we did.
That you guys were basically to the point where even the facility was saying, if any more shows up, you're going to have to turn them away because we won't have food for them.
Oh, yeah. We had about 10% more people show up than had actually signed up for the thing.
That is an incredibly nice problem to be faced with, Chuck. Yeah. I'm going to tell you right now, I haven't worked with a lot of nonprofits doing these kind of things, banquets, etc. To have 10% more than you booked is phenomenal. Usually you get 10 to 15% fewer than what RSVP'd, and you sit there with like empty chairs at certain spots around the room for people who things came up or whatever, and they couldn't make it. So
it can happen, but people ended up sitting at tables where the people didn't show up, you know, those kinds of things. And yes. When you the Villa Milano, which is where the banquet was held in Columbus there on Schrock Road, anybody who's been to a fundraiser in the Columbus area has probably been to the Villa Milano at least once. They basically came to the group, to Relationships Under Construction, that said, look, if anybody else shows up, they're starving because there's no more food. You know, they over-prepare, but they, and my gosh, when they bring you the food, you're sort of like, wow. The main meal is lasagna. And by all accounts, it's very good. I can't eat lasagna unless it's made with gluten-free pasta. But my wife said, oh my gosh, and it's a steak. I mean, the thing is huge. They bring you this giant slab of lasagna. And it's delicious. But the program itself went very, very well. And people love it because they find out what Relationships Under Construction does in the classroom. We had sample lessons. We had teachers. We had students describing what they're dealing with. So we even had people from the RUC program. Relationships Under Construction is not confined to Ohio. It's in other states. We talked about our Texas experiment, and it's also in other countries. We had a teacher from Ghana come in and talk about her experience using the curriculum in Ghana. So it's international, it's interstate, and it's a great, great group, relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Absolutely.
I want to know about Bringing America Back to Life.
Well, okay, Chuck, the Bring America Back to Life convention, for those of you who don't know and didn't get the chance to experience it this weekend, this was our ninth year of doing this, and it has become the largest single pro-life convention in the country. It takes place the second weekend in March every year in Cleveland, actually Independence, suburb of Cleveland. And Molly Smith from Cleveland Right to Life has coordinated this effort now for the last 9 years. And they get speakers in from all over the world, Chuck, not just all over the country, all over the world on topics related to life. Now, each year there seems to be a theme that develops just almost organically out of everything that's going on. And this year the theme was the idea between the push for sexual libertinism, i.e. transgenderism, etc., you know, and attacking biology and what that means for the pro-life movement. So it was very interesting. You know, we had a number of key speakers throughout the weekend, including, you know, it went from as broad a range as Dr. Les Ruppersberger, who is a fantastic speaker and a very studied medical professional regarding genetics and biology and gender issues and things of that nature, all the way to George Barna, who is a national pollster who does a lot of work with the church and with these kind of causes of doing polling nationally to kind of figure out where the trend lines lie. You know, this starts on Friday and goes goes all the way through Saturday night, and it's two full days packed with back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back speakers, breakout sessions. There are pro-life groups and organizations that have displays all up in the hotel. It's fantastic. It was very busy this weekend for me, too, because it's also the location where our Right to Life Action Coalition of Ohio, our new statewide collaborative among pro-life and pro-family groups, has its annual meeting. So we had our first annual meeting there on Thursday, the day before we come in, and so does National Personhood Alliance, which is a large number of folks from all over the country who are working to push personhood bills and amendments so that we can get to what we're all trying to get to, which is the end of abortion on demand in this country. So it was great. We went in there on Thursday and spent through and came back on Sunday. Had a great time. You can go to the website at bringingamericabacktolife.com, and you can download the speakers. They're going to be putting them up as they go. So the talks from each of the speakers were recorded, and they're going to be online. So you can go and listen to the ones that you missed. But honestly, I'd encourage anybody, if you're pro-life, this is where you want to be the second weekend of March, because you get rejuvenated, recharged, refreshed from seeing all of your folks around the country and around the world who are dealing with these issues and who are winning. We're having success in holding to a position of the fact that we don't believe in compromise. We don't believe in, okay, how can we regulate abortion? We believe in ending it. And so we're pushing strongly. And we also heard that over the weekend, we got great news, Chuck, that the state of Alabama, their state Supreme Court ruled that their personhood law was constitutional. So we know it's going to get challenged federally now by the pro-aborts, but that's a huge win for the personhood movement, is that an entire state has now basically changed their laws to reflect the humanity of the unborn from the moment of conception.
Well, what you're doing with that group is so important that it really can't be overemphasized. In fact, both what we're doing from the education end and from the protection of the unborn end are so important and pivotal, and they fit together like a machine. The cogs fit together and they turn one another. And there are other parts of this machine as well. Two people can't be involved in everything. You're involved in a lot of stuff. I am not as involved as I used to be, but I have reasons for that. Hopefully temporary reasons. And we all have to do what we can. If you're not involved in some of these things, you're going to get an opportunity today to get involved in some things, because we're going to give you some news today that opened a door for you to talk with your state representatives and state senators, because there's some stuff coming up that's really bad news. Now, after you had that great meeting, what do we get? We get a notification this morning from CCV, our friends at Citizens for Community Values, that a federal district court judge named Timothy Black.
Yeah, right.
Blocked an Ohio law that prohibits aborting children merely because they have been diagnosed with Down syndrome. Well, as you explained to me, that's not all it does. That's the surface.
No. Well, no, I mean, that's the start of it. And basically, Chuck, I can't say that I'm at all surprised.
No.
That the ProAborts
no.
Did venue shopping and went to the former legal counsel for Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio and a former president of that organization, who now sits on the court, Timothy Black. So, Black's got a history of being in the pro-abort movement and being an officer in Planned Parenthood. So, they don't randomly just send these bills up. They figure out where their friends are on the courts, and that's where they send these challenges. So we're not surprised that Black did this. But what I was slightly surprised about, because it falls in place with my first maxim of all politics, Charles, and you've heard me say this numerous times,
yep,
and I'm sure some of our listeners have too, the left will always outrun their cover, okay? And they've outrun their cover on this in two different ways. The first way being that, can you imagine the general public who's really mostly apathetic and possibly ignorant about what's going on around them in regard to the life issues, hearing the messaging that these groups want to kill babies because they've been diagnosed with Down syndrome? Now, you think about that. What they're saying is, we want to kill these people, even though everybody and their brother probably knows someone or has intersected with someone who is or is a family member of someone who has Downs. Okay?
Yep.
It's almost inescapable. The general public is going to look at this for what it really is. This is wanton butchery based upon somebody's convenience. That, oh, it's so hard to raise these kids when they have these severe issues. So we just need to, like, be compassionate on the woman and let her, you know, have her baby be murdered. I don't think it's going to fly this time because, you know, and y'all, kudos to our friends over at Ohio Right to Life who introduced the legislation originally. You know, it's great. It's hard to message against that. You know, it's hard to get people to be compassionate to your side when you're basically saying we want to kill them because they're different. Because that brings up the whole specter of the history of the subjugation of peoples because of their ethnicities, because they're not like us. You know, if you want to talk about you could use the term white nationalist movement as they're trying to demonize some people on the right. I think that basically this elitist movement of progressive liberals is much more bloodthirsty and much more, shall we say, purity-based, because they don't want anything to interfere with their rights to basically do what they feel like. And it's really, Chuck, it gets down to a sexual issue, because really at the heart of this, they're saying that all women should have the ability to go out and be as wanton as they want to be and never have to deal with a consequence, because there will always be some physician who will make a lot of money in getting rid of the resultant consequence of being promiscuous or being wanton or whatever it might be. That really kind of gets down to it in a great sense, and I think they've outrun their cover on this one.
Oh, absolutely.
But even more so, Judge Black outran the cover for the whole movement when he, during this, and this was for an injunction against the law taking effect. So we haven't heard the last of this. It's still going to have to go up through the courts and probably get to the Supreme Court about whether or not they find it that, you know, it's a violation of a woman's constitutional rights to protect the child that she's carrying in her womb from being slaughtered. And honestly, it's nightmarish that we get there. But in Black's ruling, he basically made the argument that before the point of viability, which is fungible right now, was it 20 weeks, 24 weeks, is it 15 weeks, is it, you know, is it 30, you know, is it right before birth? And of course, the pro-aborts would argue all the way to birth they should have the opportunity to slaughter their children. But he made the argument that before the point of viability, and normally the court set that at about 24 weeks, because there's challenges right even now to the pain capable, which pushes it back to 20 weeks. So about 24, so any time from the conception to 24 weeks of pregnancy, this judge says that it is a categorical right of a woman to seek an abortion. Now, for those of you not familiar with legal terminology, determining that it's a categorical right means that it's a right that cannot be infringed, reduced, modified at all by law, that regardless of what you try to do or what your purpose, whether it's the fact that, you know, we need to protect children who have chromosomal issues like Down syndrome and others, or if it's that we need to protect children who basically are getting killed because, you know, they happen to form as a boy and they wanted a little girl or vice versa, or, you know, they were killing babies because, well, oh, you know what? We only wanted one baby, and now I'm pregnant with twins, so let's kill one of them off. You know, this judge is saying it's Wild West out there, that any of those reasons, none of those reasons can be regulated or reduced by law, because a woman has a categorical right to, any time before viability, kill the baby for whatever reason they want. Now, Chuck, that really is quite stunning. given the fact that if you look at the polling going on, when you start explaining, you start doing what we call an informed ballot with people about these procedures and what happens and, you know, the life cycle of a child, that the vast majority of people are anti-abortion. They get it once you explain it to them. But there are a handful, and mainly in the pro-abort movement and their hangers-on, like Judge Timothy Black, who will never get it. But, again, I think he's outrun his cover. I think declaring this a categorical right is the point of attack for pro-life forces and pro-life attorneys to come at them to say that you cannot have a categorical right to kill another human being willy-nilly. You can't get away with – I mean, let's put it this way. If that child was born and a parent or someone else killed them, they'd be up on a murder charge.
Yeah.
But because they're pre-born and because they're pre what they consider to be being able to sustain their own selves outside the womb, kind of ignores the fact that technology is moving forward to where earlier and earlier we are being able to, you know, preserve and actually improve the life of children with, you know, different handicaps and abnormalities while they're still in the womb. It's ignoring all of that, and so I would say, using their own terminology, it's not medically accurate for him to say it's a categorical right for a woman to kill her unborn child before 24 weeks, because that doesn't reflect what's actually happening in medicine, in technology, and, I believe, in the hearts and minds of the vast majority of the American public.
Okay, I'm going to go with an argumentation path that I don't think anybody has really explored. And I'm going to do it in such a way as I'm going to use my Socratic method, so I'm going to ask you some questions. Okay, what exactly causes what we commonly call Down syndrome or, those kind of children?
A chromosomal anomaly.
Yes.
Where you have an extra chromosome, I think, on, what is it, on?
21.
21, yeah.
Number 21. Trisomy 21. A lot of what they call polysomies, in other words, you have an extra chromosome. So instead of having two pairs, they have a triploid, they have three. And that creates all kinds of odd anomalies. Now, where else do we see trisomies or polysomies?
Well, I mean, there are a number of other connectors. I mean, there's trisomy 18, there's trisomy 13. It just depends on where that extra chromosome links in on that chain.
Yeah, that's it. Right. Now, for instance, I think trisomy 18 is, I can't think of the name of the syndrome, but it's
Edwards
syndrome, yeah.
Yes, And during Bringing America Back to Life this weekend, I had the great pleasure and opportunity of having a lot of time to talk to Brad and Jesse Smith from the Detroit area, whose daughter has trisomy 18, and whose daughter, although all the medical professionals were telling them to abort the child in utero, et cetera, she wouldn't live, she wouldn't have a quality of life, she'd be dead before she was 2 years old, just celebrated her eighth birthday.
Yeah, quality of life. Give me a direct way of measuring that, will you?
It's whatever somebody else decides your life is worth.
It's subjective.
At least in the modern milieu, that's what it is.
I wouldn't want to live like that. Therefore, this child doesn't want to live like that. Therefore, we can kill it. Okay.
Well, and it's the same argument they're using for trying to push assisted suicide and euthanasia. Right. I wouldn't want to live like this.
Exactly.
You know, but the point is the fact is, you're not living like this. Someone else is, and you're trying to push to have them exterminated. That's really what it gets down to, is let's look at the deep darkness in our own souls when we push for things like abortion and euthanasia, because we're trying to be quote-unquote compassionate to those other people.
Okay, so let's take this beyond. Now, I'm going to tell you, as a biochemist, that with some developmental training many, many years ago, most polysomies are fatal. The vast majority of things like miscarriages and that kind of thing are genetic problems that God is gracious enough to not allow to develop to completion. Some of them create biological systems that simply cannot operate. And so therefore the fetus dies. When I hear arguments like Christopher Hitchens used to make that God is the worst mass murderer on the planet because he takes all these embryos and fetuses before they're allowed to be born. No, God knows exactly. He has his reasons for allowing that to happen. We don't totally know what they are. My wife had a miscarriage. I remember at a very early stage once, and it was difficult. But it led to other good things. So God, you know, all things work together for good for those who are in Christ Jesus. I mean, that's the way you have to look at it. And it's not just, you know, God has his reasons for doing everything. Okay. Let's look at other polysomies. Now, we now have a judge saying basically it's okay to kill people because they have a polysomy. I mean, that's the argument.
Yeah.
They have a polysomy that affects development of the individual, and therefore they can be killed. Well, where else do we see polysomies? Well, we see them on number 23.
Right.
Now, why is number 23 so important? Number 23 is where your sexual characteristics are located.
Aha.
So what the judge basically said was, you can now kill someone who might be trisomy 23 or quatrisomy 23. And what do those things do? Well, it depends. For instance, I've had people say, I've argued that this is a rare anomaly, and I've had people say, it's not that rare. And I'm like, 1 in 7,000 births, it's pretty rare. What does it do? Well, in some cases, it doesn't do anything. In males, it's bad. If for instance, you have an XXY or an XYY, it can create havoc in males. It can create mixed sexual characteristics. The development of both male reproductive organs and female other issues, breasts and that kind of thing. It messes with testosterone levels and that kind of thing. And it creates individuals who are really torn, who are, you know, don't know how to deal with the situation, mostly because they're, for the most part, most of those people aren't Christian that deal with that. And I'm not sure a Christian would deal with it very well. I mean, someone who wants to be just like everybody else. Now, what would you do? What would a person who was not a Christian do if they found out that they had a son? And I will put it this way. You can have multiple sexual characteristics, but if you have a Y chromosome anywhere in the mix, you are a male. That's the bottom line. If you're XXY, if you're XYY, if you're XXXY, if you're XXYY, you have a Y chromosome, you are a male. That's the bottom line. There is no such thing as transgender. There are sexual outer secondary sexual characteristics where it creates an issue for the person who has this problem. Why does God allow it? I don't know. He has his reasons. Okay. What does it do, for instance, if you have an XXY or an XYY, in other words, you are a male, what does that do to your sexual characteristics? Well, for one thing, you're sterile for the most part. You cannot pass it along. This is what is known as a developmental anomaly. It's not a passable genetic trait. This happens during when your chromosomes are dividing. One just sticks along and for some reason for the ride, for whatever reason. Okay, what happens if you're triple X? In other words, you have an extra female chromosome. Do you know, Barry? I know. I'm asking you a question.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Nothing.
Okay, well, there you go.
Triple X women have babies and don't pass it along and have no problems whatsoever. Now, what does that do? All people who are polysomies necessarily notice a difference? And the answer is no. Do you know most people who are polysomy don't know about it until they go to the doctor and they can't get pregnant. They go through all the testing and everything. Finally, somebody says, "Let's do a genotype." So they take a look at what their chromosomes look like, and somebody says, "Well, here it is." You know, very often they'll have characteristics like females will be masculine or males will be more feminine and that kind of thing. But they don't really know, and they engage with the opposite sex, assuming that they're, you know, they have normal sexual desires and that kind of thing. But they've got this other issue. The argumentation I want to have examined by people who, you know, want to think about these things is, what you've basically said is, because the quality of life will be bad and people will not be able to reproduce and there will be all these problems, people will look down on them in society and blah, 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 it's better to kill them. Is that a good argument?
No, it's not a good... Well,
it's a terrible argument.
Ethically and morally, it's not a good argument, but because ethics and morals are now mainly unbound from biblical morality,
exactly,
and from God's word, and it's basically set up of, okay, what does the ethics committee here at the hospital think, or what is the, you know, what's the morality of the polling going, you know, which way are people heading, following their own, you know, desires? That's, you know, in larger terms, that's kind of where they put their thumb down and say, well, you know, you can't impose your morality. What they're really saying is, we want to impose a different type
of
morality.
Yes, we want to impose our own morality.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the problem, Barry. And I'm not hearing anybody arguing in these terms, but when you start saying that things like polysomies are a reason to allow someone to be killed, then you open the door to all kinds of people who would otherwise live normal or relatively normal lives, and some of them wouldn't necessarily live what we would call a normal life. But you basically say it's okay to kill them because, after all, things will be rough for them, and you don't really want to do that to somebody. So, therefore, let's kill them. It's really bad reasoning. God has given them life, and he's given them life in a difficult situation for his own purposes. And we have no idea what those purposes are. And if we intercede and say that we are God, then we are essentially saying there is no God. Therefore, we have to take his place. We have to fill the vacuum. It's an arrogant way of looking at life. It's an arrogant way of operating a society. And we are essentially seeing the consequences of... 45 years of abortion, insofar as there are over 50 million people that are not with us, and we don't have their contribution, and we are not essentially, even at this point, at the replacement rate for birth. Why? Because in our selfishness, we're not having enough kids, it'll be inconvenient for me to have a girl, or it'll be inconvenient for me to have a boy. Sex selection is essentially one of the things you brought up to me with this court ruling, is that abortions for sex selection, since it's a categorical right, that if a woman who's an ultra hyper feminist doesn't want to have a boy because she doesn't want to take the chance that he might actually act like a boy, that is, be aggressive and do the things that boys do, then she's perfectly free to kill him because she don't want to deal with it. I only want girls. Okay.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. You've got a misogynist who doesn't want girls. They want boys. So keep wiping them out until we get the one we want. Or,
yeah, well, that would be the way it would work. It'd be like, well, we found out that this child's going to be, you know, less than 99 percentile on height and weight, et cetera, and won't grow to 6'3", which is what we're envisioning. So, okay, kill it.
Okay. Or for instance, I wanted a child with blue eyes and blonde hair. Yeah. Or this child's going to have red hair. Therefore, we should just end it all for him. This is the kind of genetic we are capable of this these days. We are capable of doing the testing so you can have a designer baby. Now, do we want to be able to do that? I think this is one of the worst uses of genetic testing out there. You combine that with the idea, you know, or my child, I want them to be at least 6 feet tall, blah, 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 blah. Well, there are other things that go into that. This is exactly what Adolf Hitler wanted to be able to do but couldn't pull off in the 1930s because, you know, the technology wasn't there. So what do? You essentially breed people like cattle for their characteristics. When they went into places like Norway, they simply kidnapped children that were of the right, quote-unquote, Aryan type, and brought them in to raise them as good Germans. Gave them to German families to be raised as, good Nazis. Kidnapped from their parents. Some of them, you know, were never able to get back to their parents. This is the kind of thinking, this is where things lead. And if we can't see the worldview issues, if we can't see the presuppositional issues that go along with these things, then we're kind of sunk. That's why we do shows on presuppositional thinking.
Absolutely.
Because it leads to people who are on the federal bench as Barack Obama appointees, sadly for life, in a misunderstanding of the Constitution on how judges are to be appointed during periods of good behavior. I would say that allowing the murder of infants on the basis of their having an extra chromosome is not good behavior. We're in a presuppositional nightmare at the moment, and all you got to do is look around at some of the things that are being done and some of the arguments that are being made on other things, and it's really becoming Orwellian. Mike O'Reilly this morning on our interview talked about Huxley's Brave New World, in which basically children are in the custody of the state, and the state raises them the way they want them to. And if you look at what's going on, we're there. Essentially.
Yes, we are.
Or we're on the threshold. It's not quite there, but all you have to do is look at the walkout, the gun walkout that was yesterday. We're recording on Thursday. It was done on 14th, March 14th. Essentially, the argumentation that is made, many people's children who support and defend the Second Amendment, their children were out there marching, please come and take away our guns, which is a ridiculous a position to have if you look at it from a logical standpoint. 98% of all shootings take place in a gun-free zone. Of mass shootings take place in a gun-free zone. That school, Parkland School, had a policy. They had one armed guard who went and hid behind his car, essentially, when the shooting started. Was that what he was supposed to be doing? Well, he was ordered to do that by his supervisor. I don't want to get too far into that. But the fact is, why aren't children logically being... Why isn't a logical argument out there being said, okay, what if we simply had armed guards in the building, and when somebody came in, if you come in and start shooting a place up, you're going to get shot yourself. You make yourself a hard target. Why aren't we arguing in favor of making places where there are 5,000 adults and children in one big, giant, gun-free zone a hard target? Well, the reason is that there are individuals who are willing to sacrifice 17 children. Mm-hmm. From a presuppositional standpoint, they're willing to sacrifice them in order to get their ultimate goal, which is the seizure of all guns, except the ones that the government has. This is where we are. This is where we are as a society. Sure. We have judges who basically say it's okay to murder infants because abortion is an absolute a categorical right, and you can therefore you can murder a child for any reason you want at any point.
Well, you know, and Chuck, that also is going to expand out into other areas. You know, right now we have a situation, and I think we need to talk about it. And it's not directly related on point to abortion and a judge, but it's basically related to this whole idea of, you know, who decides what's best? You and I talked about this earlier today. We were recording this on Thursday with Mike O'Reilly, and it's about the fact that our governor here in Ohio has decided that he knows what's best for everybody, just like this judge has decided he knows what's best, and is pushing for changes in law to basically force, and I'm going to be, yeah, I'll be blunt about it, to force parents and students to fall into the approved categories that the business community wants in order to make sure that they don't have to spend a lot of money on training for employees. That's really what this gets down to. This is legislation, House Bill 512. It's being pushed right now in the House to basically consolidate the higher education and the Department of Education together, along with the Office of Workforce Transformation. Lovely name. But yeah. Basically, and it's a push. This bill has come forward by Bill Reinecke, who's out of the Tiffin area, and it's a creature of the governor's executive workforce board. Now, if you don't think that sounds like a blue ribbon star chamber panel, you're wrong. It is, because this is basically a big entity that the governor put together in 2012. When he first started down this road of moaning and groaning about how he was upset that he didn't control education policy and that the State Board of Education wouldn't do what he told them to do. Now, if you think of the arrogance of that statement from John Kasich, you know, it's somewhat breathtaking that, you know, we elected you governor, and there are constitutional limitations upon that. And one of those limitations is the fact that you don't get to call all the shots in education. As a matter of fact, that's why the State Board of Education was adopted by the voters in our Constitution in 1953, I believe it was, Chuck. It was
that's
either 53
date.
Or 56.
53.
I think it was 53. To basically add an insulation level between the executive agencies of the Department of Education and the governor, and moms and dads out there and school teachers and everyone else who are in the schools. Because I think that even back in the 50s, they realized it's not really a good idea. It's not a idea for a constitutional republic, or, you know, if you want to use the horrible term, a democracy, to basically have an oligarchic or almost dictatorial form of education. Kind of smacks a little bit of command and control education that's done in communist countries, Chuck. But what it really gets down to is the governor has been basically throwing a tantrum about this since 2012. He formed this, you know, executive workforce board. There's a couple of House appointees, a couple of Senate appointees, a handful of cabinet officials, including the, but funny thing is, because they're talking about we need to align our, you know, everything up in education in the workforce so that we have this seamless transition, the one individual who was not involved on this workforce board was the superintendent of public instruction at the Department of Education, who is appointed by the state board. But you see, and the other side of that coin is that while this was going on over the last 4 or 5 years, well, it's been six since the board was appointed, but basically they issued a report in 2016 about how to go about doing this to basically realign everything for the demands of the demands of the business community. In other words, when the Ohio Business Roundtable, whose president is on the board, or, you know, the chief executives of some of these big companies, and if you look at this board, it's very interesting, Chuck, because, I mean, your chairman of the board is a venture capital entity. As a president of a venture capital group. That sounds very familiar to what Kasich did with the Department of Development by turning it over to a private venture capital entity. We call that public-private partnerships, and they really don't work either in a constitutional republic.
It's fascism, folks.
It's fascism. That's exactly what it is. Okay, I'm glad you said it, because I was going to let's beat around the bush a little bit on it. But so they issued this report, and of course, Reinecke is on this board, and so now he's become the point person, and he introduced this bill. The bill is 2,430 pages long, Charles. 2,430 pages. It was introduced about a month ago, and they were fast-tracking this bill until they ran into the buzzsaw. The buzzsaw being the homeschooling community, who saw this as a potential threat to the freedom that they enjoy under the current regulations in Ohio to educate our children without having to seek the approval of a public district superintendent or public board. Right now in Ohio, when you home educate, as you well know, as I well know, you just notify. And you're just basically saying, hey, I'm a parent. I'm exercising my parental rights. I'm educating my children at home. There it is. Now, we've had a number of instances in the state where you've had superintendents and others in different local districts who haven't figured out how to read the law yet. And so they tried to say, well, no, you have to get our approval and et cetera. And then HSLDA or some other law group comes in and says, oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's right.
You do not have to do that. And so that's been working fairly well since those rules were put into place in 1987. Okay. So it's been over 30 years of having a fairly robust homeschool community operating fairly well. I mean, I'll grant someone who makes the argument that, there are other states who have better, more protective laws on homeschooling than Ohio does because we haven't touched ours in 30 years. But the point is, and I guess I in part agree with some of the folks who were originally working on this, is if it's working, don't mess with it, because when you do, you open up the opportunity for those who are opposed to you to make them worse. So I get that. It's a balance. Well, they see this balance going away completely because of this push by the governor. And what it would do is, when they create this new agency between the Department of Education, Higher Education, and Workforce Transformation called the Department of Learning and Achievement, the director of the department is going to be a cabinet position that is responsible only to the governor, who appoints that person. Now, what happens to the State Board of Education, which is really, and right now it's a hybrid board. There's 19 members. There are 11 elected, popularly elected members from districts all around the state, which is basically 11 members. Those districts are the size of 3 contiguous Senate districts. So that's quite a few people that's over a million people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
Per district.
Yeah.
So that's quite a bit of people they have to represent, but they've been doing it fairly decently. Now, a while back when George Voinovich was governor, they pushed and got a what they call a hybridized board. So the governor now gets to appoint 7 members on top of the 11 members. And usually that's the way it works, is on top of them, because the governor's appointees tend to take over and they become president of the board, et cetera. And that's caused no end of problems. And we've always had, people in there who have been, well, shall we say, Charles, not exactly on point with all of the things that you think that the public would like in public education. They've been more on point with what the governor wants. And, of course, that's created some issues over the years, including Common Core.
Common Core, oh my gosh.
Common Core. And the State Board of Education, even though a number of the members and a number of their constituents can't stand Common Core, we've got it because you've had a push from these governor's appointed officials to back his play when he basically went all in and put all the chips in on the table in support of Common Core. So, so there's a problem there right now. And we will go with that. And here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get this done so that they can take over and shut the board down. Now, Kasich's already done this with higher education because he appoints all of the members to that board of the Board of Regents. And what he's been doing over the last few years is, when an opening comes up on the Board of Regents, he's just not appointing anybody. So he's basically, by small cuts, killed that board. And that was part of the game plan, was to kill off the board, this independent board, so that they'd be more easily sucked into this large conglomeration that they're doing. You know, they'll try to do the same thing with the Board of Education, but they know they can't do it because there's actually publicly elected individuals on the board that they can't really touch. So what do? Well, we're going to just take away all the board's responsibilities. All they're going to end up being is a entity that reviews the licensure and licensure suspensions and revocations of teachers.
It's a rubber
stamp.
That's
all they want it to do.
It's a rubber stamp.
It's a rubber stamp. Of course, there are board members who have taken umbrage to that. And as a matter of fact, this week, the board voted overwhelmingly, including with some of the governor's appointees voting in favor, to oppose House Bill 512. A couple of their members, actually two, I think three different board members came in and testified in opposition to the bill. So did the Christian Home Educators. So did many others. But who came in and testified in favor of the bill? The High Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce. All the business entities who basically all they care about is, we want to turn the schools into our training facilities so that when these kids come out, you know, we can just go, well, we want this group of kids over here to come to work in this industry because that's all they know. Because they've been siloed from kindergarten into those particular areas. And if, you know, the industry says we need more people who, you know, can code, they'll push kids into a silo of, you know, computer coding. If they say we need more people in here who can sweep the floor, well, they'll push them over here into this general track so that when they get out, then what they'll be able to do, you know, intellectually and educationally is sweep floors in a factory. It's horrifying. You're right. It's fascism. People are getting this point, and they're raising a stink about it. As a matter of fact, on Wednesday of this week, there was another hearing, the fourth hearing this bill's had. There were 13 who testified, Chuck, publicly. 12 were opponents of the bill, and the 13th was the Chamber of Commerce, who basically came in as a quote-unquote interested party, but when you read their testimony, realized that they're all in favor of it. They just want to have some breakdowns about how much money is going to go toward the workforce development.
Yeah, it's the degree of fascism you're adopting, not that you're actually adopting fascism. Yeah. What people don't seem to realize is that this is actually Soviet-style education, that the state decides what kind of workers are needed and what you are suited for. The state decides where you will go to school. The state makes all necessary decisions, and the parents have no say, essentially. Now, the parents can raise Cain and do this and do that and another thing, and here's what the bureaucrats will say. It's out of our hands. It's in the hands of the board. Well, who's the board? The board will be hand-picked cronies of the governor, flat out. So when you elect a gubernatorial candidate, you don't know for sure exactly what his educational standpoint is. If, you know, for instance, if I was running for governor and this was the law, the first thing I would ask to do and on this campaign stump and say, dismantle this thing. Turn the decisions back to the parents. Remember what in the Bible where it says, raise a child up in the way they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. That's not written to the state. That's written to the parents. It's parents who are supposed to guide and mold their child. Now, what the state is basically saying in this is, no, you can't do that. We're better at it than you are. We're smarter. We have higher degrees than you do. Therefore, we can determine what path your child needs to take better than you can.
Right.
And parents should be hopping mad over this. Hopping mad.
Oh, they are, Chuck. I mean, it's, I'm on at least two or three different Facebook groups of Ohio parents who have been coordinating, and that's who's been coming in and, you know, we've had wave upon wave of opposition ever since. Because the first hearing was just for the sponsor to tell his side of it and what he believed the bill would do. The second hearing was for proponents, like Business Roundtable folks, to come in. The third hearing was for opponents, and that's when the doors blew off. It was an all-day hearing last week. And, of course, they had a bunch of other bills, but once they got through those other bills, they started in on this bill probably around 11:30 in the morning. And then, of course, they had to break because they had a session and a caucus, et cetera. So they went from 11:30 to about 12:30, then they broke, and they came back at 3, and they went from 3 until 8:30 in the evening with opponents on this bill, okay? One right after the other, with no major breaks. That's what you're looking at was, there was a problem, and they've now realized they've got a big problem, to the point where I had a report yesterday that during the testimony, the sponsor of the bill, who sits on the committee, Bill Reinecke, got so incensed that these people just couldn't understand how wonderful this bill was that he stormed out of the hearing room when he couldn't get a witness to basically concede a point he was trying to get them to make. That he got visibly upset and then stormed out. You know, it wasn't like he had to get up and leave to go to another committee, et cetera. He stormed right out. So I think it's very interesting that, and of course, if you talk, and some people have talked to, and I know you've talked to a member of the legislature yourself about this, who basically are saying, well, they're not really fast-tracking it. It's like, well, they were fast-tracking it until they realized that it was going to blow up in their faces and be, they were going to take a lot of collateral damage out of it. So, yeah, I'm guessing they've slowed it down a little bit, but the goal is still to push this bill out and give it to the governor.
Barry, it's the old Everett Dirksen quote, when we feel the heat, we see the light.
We feel the heat, we see the light. That's right. And so, you've got this situation going on, so we're basically trying to figure out, and my point is that, yeah, and they may be slowing this bill down because they're figuring out how to wrap all that into something else, oh, sort of like the capital budget, because, this is dealing with a reorganization of state agencies, and there's supposedly some fiscal aspects of it of, we have to create different signage and other things, and we're going to transfer, the chancellor of the Board of Regents salary over to this new director. And so, yeah, there's some budgetary things. So they could roll all this into the cap budget, which actually left the House and is sitting over in the Senate right now. They could pop that in the Senate, give it back to the House, and it'd be in place. And, of course, what's going to happen? How many members are going to vote against getting brick-and-mortar, shovel-ready jobs in their district, money for that from the state? That's usually the way they play these games. They wrap something that people are upset about into this, into this other fabric, so that it can pass.
And that's the sad part.
So that's what I'm looking at right now is whether or not we need to be, deeply concerned about the capital budget going through.
Uh huh. It's the games politicians play.
Mm-hmm.
We can't get through the front door, therefore we're going to go through the back door.
Yep.
Well, look, parents out there, you need to first of all, let's tell people what this bill is. It's House Bill 512.
Right.
House Bill 512. Now, why am I emphasizing this? Folks, call your state legislator, your state. Right now, it's in the House because it's a House bill. It's in a House committee. If it passes out of the House, it will go over to the Senate. And again, it'll get kind of the same treatment over there. It'll have to go through the whole. I'm guessing that there's a Senate companion. That's your bailiwick.
No, there's not. There's not. That's the reason why I'm more than a little concerned about the potential of them doing this flip over.
Yeah, this is not good. I get it. Okay, it's House Bill 512. Call or write, email, fax, whatever, your state representative. Don't know who your state representative is? Okay, here's how you find out. You go to ohiohouse.gov. And, here it is. I'm sorry. Wipe that out. Legislature.ohio.gov.
That's right.
Legislature.ohio.gov. And there is a place where you can press a button, and it says Find My Legislators. And you put in your zip code, your zip plus four, and your legislator, but you can tell it both Senate and House. And you can slam the door on this, by the way, this capital budget maneuver, by simply saying, I don't want you to support this either as a standalone bill or part of the capital budget.
True.
Period. I don't.
Absolutely.
If you do, you are in trouble. I mean, don't threaten anybody. The only legitimate threat is you're not getting my vote next time. But go Ohio. Legislature.ohio.gov /legislators/ find my legislator. And essentially, you put in your zip and your zip plus four, and your legislator will pop up. Give them a call. Tell them you oppose HB 512 and you oppose moving it over to the capital budget. We'll post a link on our website attached with today's broadcast to that, so you can find it. So you can find it, and it'll be a hot link. It'll take you right to the right page. You need to get involved, folks. You really do. This is one of those things. If you allow the state to take over education in this way, this is something that, as conservatives, we've been fighting for decades. Decades. One of the arguments I got from someone who is supposedly a conservative is that centralization of the education department, of the educational departments in Ohio, has been a grave disaster. Therefore, what we need is actually more centralization. This was his argument to me.
Did he realize who he was arguing that to?
No,
no. I guess that's my question, because honestly, if anybody has ever argued, like a politician's ever argued with you on anything when you come in to testify or anything else, or when you do presentations, they usually find themselves on the very short end of that stick.
Yeah, this was in a group phone call with a board, and okay. I was restrained by the chair. Because
shame on that chair.
I was going to let him have it. I think he had another plan in mind, but he just wanted to let him talk and get it out. Essentially, this was a guy who purports himself to be a conservative and isn't. And again, folks, if you think your state legislator is conservative, examine his record and find out where he stands on HB 512, because that'll tell you whether he's a real conservative or not. He or yep. she, pardon me. There are females out there, and some of them are pretty good. Some of them are beyond pretty
good.
And
some of them are not.
Yeah. And some of them are terrible. Yeah. And well, same thing with the guys. It's not, right. not sex based.
Well, you know, we're pushing, because this only had a handful. This House Bill 512 only had a handful of co-sponsors on it, but what two of the co-sponsors? One of them is the chair of the House Education Committee, you know, and we've been trying to convince him that he needs to back away from it. And the other is a homeschooling dad who, frankly, I'm not sure why he thought this was a good idea to support this bill, but he's been taking an awful lot of pressure and heat from back in his district, and he. Both of those individuals, to my understanding, they haven't said it directly to me, but they've said it to others who've basically made it public, that they can't support the bill, quote unquote, in its current form.
Yeah, that's
now, which means I'm looking for leadership to come up with some goofball amendment
yeah.
that makes it sound like that this bill won't do any of the stuff that we're saying it will, but they'll take it out in the Senate, so I can go ahead and vote
right.
for it, because that's what'll happen. They'll add an amendment to basically call everybody, you know, calm down. These folks will vote for it, knowing that they've got cover. Then it goes to the Senate, and the Senate strips that amendment out and sends it back. How it works. When they want something badly enough, they will do anything, including being underhanded, in order to get there.
I'll guarantee you the homeschool dad is operating out of naivete and doesn't understand how the system works and has been sold a bill of goods.
Very true. Very true. There's probably that. But sometimes you have to say that some people go into these things willingly too.
Yeah, they do.
Because they're looking to move ahead.
Okay.
They're looking to garner favor from, you know, who they see as being the power broker.
I hate to cut off discussion. We're out of time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I know. That's the way it works. Folks, call your state legislator in opposition to HB 512. That's House Bill 512. You know what we think about these things. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.